scheduled to sort of try and join us later here today. And so when she gets here, she will be the one that is really leading the delegation. However, we have a mandate to continue. Thanks, Chair Marissa.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Marissa Sanikak, and I'm the aide for legal at CG.
Thank you. From the side of the department,
thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Solo Roberts, the Department of Justice, the drafter of the bill.
Okay, thank you. We also have a team of support staff with us as well. I think I can just quickly introduce them. We have Gershwin Dixon, who's the committee secretary, and I'm sure he's the person you've been writing with. We have Patricia Whittle on the far end, my far left. She's our committee researcher, and we have Barbara Ross. Barbara Ross, and she's from our legal team. Okay. And Simongile is somewhere. You'll see a lady who's walking around and assisting us. She's the committee assistant. Once again, welcome. Honourable Members, the projector is not speaking to the computer. We're having a cyber issue. we do have copies of their presentation. You should have a copy with you. And I'm proposing that we continue. I'm proposing that we continue. If it gets pulled as well, we can. I'm not sure who's doing the presentation. Is it yourself, Kikesu, or Marissa?
Marissa.
Okay. Over to you, then, Marissa. If you could speak to your written submission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members. The Commission would like to thank the committee for the invitation to present our submission to Parliament. The Commission is an independent body created under Chapter 9 of the Institution of the Constitution, and our mandate is to protect and promote gender equality. This mandate goes further in terms of monitoring and evaluation and investigation of government, civil society, and private sector as well. Our mandate is further mediated by the Commission for Gender Equality Act, 1996, as amended, and that further gives us the powers to evaluate and monitor practices and policies of all the state, statutory bodies and functionaries, public bodies and authorities and the like. Against our mandate, as a backdrop of our mandate, we have then made a submission to the Honourable Committee in terms of the Cyber Crimes Act, or Belfort rather. There are various forms of cyber activities that may qualify as cyber violence against women and girls. Our main aim is more to engender the bill as it currently stands. The violence against women and girls includes in the area cyber stalking, non-consensual pornography or revenge porn, gender-based slurs, harassment based on gender or sexual orientation, slut shaming, unsolicited pornography, extortion, human trafficking, rape and death. Cyber stalking is stalking by means of email, text, social media posts and messages, or via the internet. Stalking involves repeated incidents which may or may not individually be innocuous acts, but combined as a minor difference in safety and security, and causes distress, fear, and alarm. Cyber harassment can take many forms. One of the social media accounts and phones and can aim to inflict real damage on the target's real world life. Provision should also be made for victims in the live broadcasting of incidents of sexual assault and rape by social media and the impact thereof. There's a trend where many have found genuine violence on video and then either the live stream or posted on social media, which then causes the devastating impact. There's further also the trend where children and teenagers are taught via various social media platforms and how to do self-harm or even commit suicide. In terms of our submissions for the bill, the Commission took the view that the definition of a minor must be reflective as per the Children's Act and they should be included in the bill. In other words, any child is then a person under the age of 18 years. The definition of cyber violence, it includes but it's not limited to cyberstalking, non-consensual pornography and revenge porn, gender-based prison harassment, slut shaming and the like. Definitions might also be given for the act that constitutes cyber violence in the bill. In terms of Section 10, cyber extortion as described in Section 10 must be expanded to include extortion or blackmail through revenge porn or non-consensual pornography or sharing of intimate images. The concept is known as extortion. Cyber extortion as a concept should not only focus on the unlawful acquiring of data, the interference with data, data storage or programming, password and access code, but should also look at the sexual connotations. Aggravated offences in Section 11. Section 11 2 refers to severe instances where a person may be guilty of an aggravated offence. CGE submits that person that infringes on the dignity and privacy as well as the mental and emotional integrity of a person may be found guilty of an aggravated offence. So CGE therefore submits that the amendment must be called to Section 11. We propose that it should be that any person who commits an offence referred to in Section 5, 1, 6, 1 or 10, which violates the dignity or privacy of any person or any number of persons, or cause mental and emotional harm to a person or any number of persons, that may also the rest of the section follows. In terms of Section 16, data messages which incite damage to property or violence, CGE supports Rule 16, but submits that acts of sound violence are submitted under the definition should result under Rule 16, with a specific reference to the recording of sexual violence and rape on social media platforms and other electronic means. Online human trafficking should also be addressed in Section 16 as an intention to incite violence or harm against a person or a group of persons. Section 17 that deals with data messages which are harmful. The CGE supports Clause 17 and submits that the concept of cyber harassment and cyber stalking should also be included in Section 17. We therefore submit that it should read in the subsection 2 for the purposes of subsection 1 a data message is harmful when and then include each cyber harassment or cyber stalking which is of a sexual nature are taking place by using data messages on the system or broadcasting system. Section 18. Distribution of data messages of intimate image without consent. We support Section 18 and recommend a sub-clause of Section 18 which reads that any person who unlawfully and intentionally makes available, broadcast or distribute by means of a computer system a data message of an intimate image of a child is guilty of an offence despite the consent of the 219 in order to protect the complainant pending finalisation of criminal proceedings. PG supports section 19 that highlights that the aggravating factors to be considered for imposing sentence and recommends the following additional aggravating factors which must be included under section 19. The fact that the depiction of the intimate image was of a child, the fact that and the extent of the minor child has been exposed to the intimate image, the fact that the depiction of the intimate image was the person who are mentally disabled, the fact that and the extent to which a person who are mentally disabled has been exposed to the image. In other words, two categories which we propose to come in, one as children and secondly as disability. In terms of penalties, which is contained in section 22, support the provisions of section 22, but submit that a register of offenders should be established in terms of offences relating to cyber violence and sexual offences. The register should have some functionality and purpose as the register prescribed by the Children's Act. We therefore submit that it should be that any person who contravenes the provisions of section 16, 17 and 18 is liable on convictions of fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years or to both the fine and such imprisonment. The person who contravenes the provision detail will be captured in a register in respect to cyber violence and sexual offences. In conclusion, the CGE thanks the committee for the opportunity to present and we welcome the engagement in the matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much, Marissa. Our members, I think in terms of our procedure yesterday, I'm going to first see if the department has any questions or clarity before I allow you to respond to it.
Thank you, Ms. Chairperson. I must point out that the commission did not address the offences in the shield of the rule that relates to amendments to the Sexual Offences Act, where we explicitly deal with revenge pornography, which among others include extortion relating to pornography. My submission is therefore that clause 10 of the bill should not be amended, since the Sexual Offences Act is amended specifically to deal with pornography used during extortion. Regarding the reference to clause 11, the aggravated type of offences, my submission that since the specific offences in the Sexual Offences Act, which is going to be necessary to the cyber bill, it's probably not necessary to refer to extortion or clause 11. Further, my submission that clauses 5161 of the bill should actually not be applicable to, let's call it cyber violence or sexual extortion. The Commission of Gender Equality can try to motivate why that offence must specifically be applicable to such kind of conduct. In this submission, the Commission referred to wrong sections or clauses in the bill. When they referred to section 16, it's actually clause 14 currently in the bill. Rather message which incite damage or damage to property or violence. I just want to find out, since there's already cyber specific offences and in light of other legislation like Protection of Harassment Act, that has been implemented or is in operation for a long time. If it's read in conjunction with the current clause 14 and probably also 15, does this two clauses not in any event go wide enough to deal with the gender-based violence on the internet. I can also refer to the Domestic Violence Act. And with reference to human trafficking, I believe in the Trafficking in Persons Act there is specifically a clause that already criminalized the distribution of messages relating to traffic, and the court can impose extremely stiff penalty. So my question is, was it necessary to amend clause 14 and 15 to also deal with that? Regarding your reference to clause 18, we must specifically provide for children. It's my submission, if you look at the Sexual Offences Act pertaining to child pornography, has got the extreme wide definition of child pornography. Will this kind of offence not the same resort under the Sexual Offences Act, maybe child pornography? And I refer now to the Sexual Offences Act as it will be amended by Cybercrimes Bill. And so, in light of that, if it's really necessary to further amend the current clause 18, my submission is that if you look at the offences to be inserted in the Sexual Offences Act through the cyber law, will the insertion of a name of an offender not automatically also being, when he's convicted, qualified to be inserted in the register for sexual offences? I think I went through your submissions. I just tried to give some comments or at least ask you for further clarification in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. From the side of the Commission, you can broadly comment about what you said, and then I'll ask members to interact with you.
Violence is a real threat to South Africa. It's a crisis. It's a national crisis. And the more we can include
material, but in the end, shouldn't all these crimes be under one umbrella? One is the legislation, where you can pull from the Sexual Offences Act, from human trafficking, from domestic violence, where as far as it's cyber concerned, and be under one umbrella to be dealt with. In terms of the register, if the cyber crimes bill and subsequent act will make provision that these offences will follow in the same register as the normal sexual offences, then both then the commission agrees that the register must be updated and functional and indicate this is a cyber crime. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Our members, do you have any other questions for clarity from the commission?
In terms of when you look at how the implementers of these bills, of these acts, once they're enforced, immediately forward, say, for work, it becomes a real problem. So, and you are supposed to be doing a whole lot of other things, by the way, on this thing. I wonder. Like, it makes you even more worried. we are done. No, you're going to the office. I can do it so that we can see you. You want to see you go to the office. We get that. No. We see you. We see you. We get in the office. Yeah, they're going to do it. I think they're going to do it for you. And then, this guy is going to do it. And then, this guy is going to do it. Then, this is going to do it for us. Because,
afternoon. My name is Dr. Ashley Shorty. I'm representing MTN. I'm the senior manager in charge of law enforcement liaison within MTN. We would like to take this opportunity on behalf of MTN to thank the Select Committee for inviting MTN to submit both written submissions in respect of the cyber crime bill and to present to you here today. We commend the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development in terms of the positive changes that will be brought about by this law. We all take cognizance of the fact that addressing cybercrime and cybersecurity by its very nature is imperative. There's been a huge scourge and an increase in cybercrime being committed, and it is up to us as role players in the industry to work together with the Department of Justice, law enforcement, to aid and assist wherever we can in addressing this current scourge which is facing our country. We also welcome the proactive steps being taken by Parliament through this bill in respect of addressing the rising threat of cybercrime in our country. At the same time, however, we have to be cognizant of the fact that the bill does have some significant implications for us as electronic communication service providers, and there could be potentially material adverse consequences which may not have been intentional or intended by the drafting of the bill. Our submission as MTN, and I will take you through them, is to focus on a few issues that we have raised in our written submission. The first of them being the harmonization with other laws and the leading practice standards and frameworks. Now, it is our submission as MTN that insofar as the bill is concerned, the submission of electronic evidence in civil and criminal proceedings has to be taken into account. In this respect, we respectfully submit that the bill does not sufficiently harmonize with, especially in relation of matters of electronic evidence production and preservation, with the Electronic Communication and Transaction Act. In this regard, it is our respectful submission that the bill take into account the provisions as per the Electronic Communication and Transaction Act and apply the same standards in respect of the submission of electronic evidence in terms of the cybercrime bill. Now, why we are submitting as MTN that there are onerous evidence preservation and disclosure obligations in the bill is simply that it does not take into account the data protection laws that currently exist, both in terms of POPI as well as the regulation of Interception Act, as well as the fact that certain aspects of the bill in terms of disclosure of information may lead to breaches of confidentiality and privacy, especially in relation to the submission of this information to law enforcement. Now, our main submission in respect of the harmonization with other laws is simply this, that the bill makes it easier for law enforcement to get access to real-time computer evidence that is required, and it allows for the expedited preservation of electronic evidence. Our submission in this is that whilst it is crucial and quintessential that cybercrime be stopped in its tracks, there also has to be cognizance taken of the fact that there are individual constitutional rights to dignity, privacy, as well as the freedom of expression. In saying so, we also submit that the implications of the POPI Act, especially concerning lawful processing of information and offences stipulated within the Act, we are submitting that those particular provisions be taken into account. Insofar as it relates to the definition of certain offences within the Act, we as MTN submit that some of the definitions, and I will take you through each of the definitions which we as MTN have raised in our submission, be reworded to take into account that some of the definitions create offences when, in fact, it should not be an offence, especially if it involves the lawful processing or the lawful interference in the ordinary course of system maintenance, upgrades, testings, etc. As an example, the definition of the word article in the book, we are submitting that this particular definition is vague. It is a catch-all reference to include data, computer program, computer data storage medium, or computer system. And this lead, or this could potentially lead to confusion and an unduly broad application of rights, powers, and obligations in terms of the book. The second definition which we have raised as problematic is the word computer. It is our submission that the broad and vague inclusion of any equipment and devices that is connected or related to a computer, and this could lead to vague and broad search and seizure warrants being issued. Now, why we are submitting this is that by creating a very broad and overall definition of the word computer, it permits law enforcement to be able to, under the search warrant, seize any computer or any network drive that is connected or associated with that particular crime, which the law enforcement officer or agency have identified. And what we are saying is that if this broad definition is included in the book, it will lead to adverse consequences for us as electronic communication service providers, but not only to us, to our customers whose information may be jeopardized in terms of the search and seizure warrant. The next definition that is included in the bill relates to output of data. We submit that this definition be revised, and the reason why we submit that the definition be revised is due to the fact that display of data or output of data could also include what we term as a continuous transmission of data. Data does not exist in a vacuum. It starts at point A and ends at point B. And in terms of the definition, we are saying that cognizance has to be taken of the fact that data has various sources. It has a start point and an end point. And it is important that when law enforcement are being equipped with a search and seizure warrant, that they take cognizance of this fact and not only focus on the electronic communication service provider as the conduit by which this particular data has been relayed. We also submitted that in terms of cybercrime, it is important to note that data traffic, which as it is identified in the bill, is broadly defined to include the communication format, duration, or type of the underlying service. Now, what this essentially means is that, especially from an electronic communication service provider perspective, as I've indicated, we are only used as conduits by which people connect to social media, WhatsApp, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. And we are not necessarily the holders of such information. Where we are submitting that the bill itself creates an onerous obligation on us is that we may not necessarily have control over what information is being relayed via these over-the-top services. As electronic communication service providers, we do not monitor, nor do we intercept such data traffic. All we're doing is that we're facilitating the relay of that information. So if, as an example, law enforcement is equipped with a search and seizure warrant in terms of the bill, we may not necessarily be the holders of that information. And it is imperative that the bill takes into account the fact that, and I think inroads have been made in terms of redefining the interception of data and the storage of data, especially in relation to the preservation orders that have been included in the bill. In terms of Chapter 4 and in terms of Section 29 of the bill, I see, and we have noted in our written submissions, that the bill still makes reference to a judge or a magistrate as being given the authority to authorize person that should be authorized to provide a search and seizure warrant be the designated judge in terms of RICO. The reason as to why we submit this is simply that the judge in terms of RICO will be in a better position to assess the merits of the applications that are being made for search and seizure and access warrants. And it will we also submit that by doing so, this will give effect to the provisions of the Protection of Personal Information Act, especially in relation to the protection and confidentiality of the information being sought from the electronic communication service providers. While we submit further that we all know that there have been numerous complaints in terms of especially relating to RICA and the interception process that has been followed, and we are submitting that to further safeguard individuals' right to privacy, etc., that the RICA judge be also tasked with this particular responsibility. We are submitting, and with all due respect, that the RICA judge will be able to apply his or her mind appropriately to access and seizure warrants that are being granted, and will give effect to protection and confidentiality of information being sought. Now, insofar as the bill creates the right for law enforcement to seize information that is required in respect of the commission of cybercrime, we as MTN are submitting that the current wording in the bill creates the suggestion that the state may seize the actual electronic communication network of an electronic communication service provider such as MTN. We submit that this is both unnecessary and not practical. The extensive seizure powers that have been granted to the state through the bill could limit us as MTN in terms of the daily operations. It could affect our customers if the state, in terms of the way the bill is currently drafted, has authority to seize electronic communication systems where the state has suspected that cybercrime has been committed. Our submission and what we have submitted is that, as opposed to the seizure of an electronic communications network or system, that law enforcement, together with assistance from the ECSPs, such as us, obtaining digital information which proves the existence of cybercrime that has occurred. By doing so, and we as the electronic communication service providers are more than willing to assist the state and law enforcement agency in terms of securing the information, making digital copies of that particular information, and then making it available for prosecution purposes. This is where the preservation orders can come into effect after the judge who we submit should be appointed in terms of RICA, has made such an order. What we are submitting is that this will cause little damage to us as the electronic communication service providers in terms of interruption of services and interruption to our customers, and it will be more beneficial for the state and law enforcement to be able to obtain digital information to prove the existence of such crime. We also submit that in terms of the seizure powers given to the state, we are submitting that this would be unlawful for the state to be able to seize the computer network or computer systems of an electronic communication service provider, primarily because most of this information is either stored on hardware or in cloud environments, and it will be a mammoth undertaking for the state and law enforcement to be able to seize this information without actually knowing what it is that they are looking for. However, with the expertise and the knowledge and the assistance from the electronic communication service providers such as ourselves, we could aid law enforcement in terms of identifying the particular instance of cybercrime and then furnishing law enforcement with the information that they require to prove the existence of such crime. Ultimately, in this respect, we submit as MTN that there need to be limitations that need to be specified in the warrant for search and seizure, and that such limitations be submit that the rationale for this is simply this, that any cybersecurity threat or incident that is occurred on the network of the electronic communication service provider will be easily identified by ourselves. We address it in the access control layers of the network, and we then provide the associated information to law enforcement for them to continue with their particular investigations. Insofar as, and I previously alluded to this, in terms of data messages and the preservation and disclosure obligations, what we are submitting, and a very simple example relating to this, is that the bill currently as it stands creates a scenario where any person who lays a charge with the police services may apply to court for an order pending the finalization of proceedings to prohibit a person from making available, broadcasting, or distributing any data messages associated with that particular charge, or may order an electronic communication service provider to disable access to the data messages which had offended the particular complaint. As alluded to earlier, we are not the originators of that data message, whether it be via Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, etc. And as such, we do not have access to that information. In order for us to act in terms of the interim order granted by the court to prevent an ECSP or the person who has laid committed the offense, that means we would need to identify the type of data message, intercept that data message, and monitor that data message. And it would be an exercise, a futility for us to do so, because we do not know the type of data messages that are being relayed by our mobile networks. So we are saying that those portions of the bill are particularly onerous on us as electronic communication service providers, and cognizance needs to be taken of that particular fact. We furthermore submit that in terms of the obligations created on the ECSPs, we are more than prepared to provide the law enforcement agencies or the state with the technical assistance that is required in order for the state to continue its investigations. And under those circumstances, it would not be necessary in terms of the seizure obligations for law enforcement to seize the computer network or programs in place within an ECSP. We also submit that in terms of the bill criminalizes the obstruction or hindering of a police official or an investigator to conduct an investigation. While we submit that we are more than prepared to assist the state and law enforcement in conducting its investigation, we submit for the state to be given powers to seize equipment belonging to an ECSP will cause us irreparable financial harm, in that the article or equipment that may be seized could be critical to our day-to-day operations, and it may impact service delivery to our customers. In respect of these aspects of the bill, we once again iterate that the bill creates a scenario where digital copies of the information that is required by law enforcement be rather requested and furnished as opposed to actual seizure of our equipment. In conclusion, we submit that the creation of the offences through the bill and addressing cyber-related crime is a necessary and welcome initiative. We submit that cognizance be taken of the cost of compliance in respect of ECSPs and other affected parties, the level of expertise within law enforcement to be able to identify where they could rely on us as ECSPs in terms of our knowledge, expertise, and know-how. And as I indicated earlier on, we need to work together as partners in addressing cyber crime. We cannot work as independents or in isolated scenarios, but together as a collective, we can ensure that collectively we address cyber crime in the country. And Madam Chair, those are our submissions.
Thank you very much for that presentation. We can head over to Saul. If there are areas of clarity, we did deal with the challenges that are faced by the ECSP providers. I think yesterday there was a presentation by Malcolm as well around some of the issues that you raised. But let me hand over to Saul around the question of clarity, and then on that we'll follow.
Thank you, Ms. Chairperson. Want to call in Rakesh, it's actually my friend. But Mr. Ishwadin, the Digital Criminal Procedure Act and broad definition of article in the Criminal Procedure Act. Currently, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, the South African police can seize your electronic communication system. Is that correct? But there are certain safeguards that is built into relevant provisions, namely that the search warrant must be narrowly framed and leads to any search article that is directly involved in an offence. So by implication, all the interpretations that has been given to a warrant to seize evidence in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act should a factor apply to one in terms of cyber law. You agree with that? Furthermore, in the bill there is various clauses, you call them scales clauses, which actually limits the powers and the manner and how they can be performed. Does that not the same provide sufficient protection against the seizure of your own system? You can answer me later on that. But on the other hand, I want to refer you to a probable scenario where the seizure of our electronic system may be, let's call it lawful and not over-exaggeration of powers of seizure and search and seize. Electronic communication service provider, ISP, as a whole network, and the whole network, the primary purpose is to distribute pornography. So the pornography is scattered all around the servers, let's say, the average form of Gauteng. So it's all the servers in Gauteng. We should agree that at least in that circumstances, if the police can motivate it, that they that the warrant to seize the whole network will not be unlawful. We agree with something like that. But you can answer me later on that. Regarding to address your concern further, in terms of the cyber bill, I think it's clause 44. There's a provision that, provides that for disclosure of data direction may be issued by a judicial officer where it's otherwise not necessary to issue a search warrant. Surely that will cater in most instances for you as well as the banks. Since in terms of that order, a judge can just tell you, give us the information and we'll provide it. And it's obviously then not necessary to search and seize. I will address your comments in writing through later on, but I'm just going to ask a few questions to clarify and maybe give comments on it. Regarding the definition of article in the cyber world, articles defines the boundaries of what can be said and seen. If you look at the Criminal Procedure Act, the police can actually search and seize anything. In terms of the cyber law, the article is data, a computer, a computer data storage media, and a computer system. Obviously, if we do not include all that objective in that definition of article, there is going to be a serious lacuna in the Act due to the fact that the Act does not authorize the police to search and seize certain things. So from my side, it is probably necessary to include all that. I would like your comment on that. Regarding the broad definition of computer, this question came up yesterday in the committee. I did point out to the committee that if you draft cyber crime legislation, your definitions must be substantially in line with that of the international community to facilitate international cooperation. And that did refer then, amongst others, to the Budapest Convention, the AU Convention, and legislation of most other countries, which definition or their definition is in line with the definition in the bill. So since all other countries give such extensive interpretation to computer, my submission that we should stick with the current definition in the bill. Before we get into the committee, we had a discussion amongst others to a computer data storage medium. Previously in the bill, there was a reference to location from which data could be reproduced. I take it up previously, but I've got a concern. If we deal with cloud computing, there's actually no physical area from which you can obtain data. Data is in the cloud. So it's not necessary that we probably relook at that and probably extend the definition to also, again, include the location from which data can be reproduced. Regarding the Copier, in your submission you refer extensively to Copier and the other service providers do so as well. And then I refer them to the Copier in section 6.1. C, which actually says that the copia does not apply when it comes to search and seizure or conduct to combat crime, terrorism, or to etc. money laundering. So, in light of that provision of the copia, do you think that copia can readily be interpret to be applicable to search and seizures? And now, if you look at the EU, there is certain data protection directives that do regulate the manner in which you must deal with intercepted evidence, as well as how long you can retain evidence that was seized. And in South Africa, and even in the Copia, there is currently no such obligation on law enforcement. Just want you to clarify that maybe to the committee. Yesterday, Talcum also referred to the deferability of the designated judge to issue directions in terms of the cyber law for search and seizure. Currently, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, all the magistrates can issue warrants which authorize law enforcement to seize a computer or data. Regarding the protection orders and the obligation that's put on you to either remove the data, the initial data from your system or wherever it is, or take measures to ensure that people cannot access that data. We had a discussion previously when we did the Detection of Harassment Act, and yes, no, you cannot do it. If it's not in your network, you cannot touch it. It's in somebody else's network. Obviously, legislation must be interpreted in line that renders it functioning. And look, it's my submission. The court can never put an obligation on you to take some of Twitter, which is in any case an external service provider where that harmful communication is outside South Africa. You can probably comment on that, but it's my submission, the court can never order you to do that.
Providing the facilitation of
that person being able to connect to the internet or for user services offered by an ECSP. In respect of the other aspects surrounding the disclosure of data directions, we concur that the world, especially as you referenced clause 44, does create for the disclosure of data as opposed to seizure of information, and then we support that. But what we're saying is that other aspects of the world also create an obligation for search, seizure, and accessing. And we're saying that if the two processes, whether it be clause 44 in terms of the disclosure of data direction as opposed to seizure, we are not sure which process law enforcement will adopt in terms of approaching an ECSP for information. What we submit with due respect is that perhaps the regulations that will be drafted in line with the bill will create the different scenarios that law enforcement can then adopt in terms of applying for disclosure or access or seizure. And we submit respectfully that this will probably create or remove any doubt in respect of the confusion created between search, seizure, and disclosure. I just want to see if I've covered probably anything else. But as indicated, if there are issues that I've missed, I will respond in writing to Mr. Roberts. I have to those are my submissions.
an observation, Chair, that perhaps we need at another level to have extensive engagement on this submission, because I'm getting something from NGN and Telecom. I'm getting some common concerns, which I think they need to be taken. Perhaps we will have to, at some particular point, have to have an engagement as custodians of many networks that we use. But what I wanted to check. All these international cyber something here in the country. That is not necessarily aligned to the global village that we live. Those are the questions here.
Thank you,
Honourable
Members.
Mr.
Ishidi, you can respond to that.
With your permission, I think the questions that have come from the committee members are quite detailed, and I think it would be best for me to rather respond in writing. Just going back to the honourable members, time frame for deliberation, how soon would you like this particular response? I can have them ready by Monday at the latest, if not before. Then I will respond to all the questions raised by the committee members in writing. Thank you.
That's fine. But thank you very much for your input as well as your deliberation today. As I indicated earlier, that as a committee, we will take your input as the principle first. Thank you very much. You're welcome to remain in the session as we move on to the next stakeholder, or if you have time constraints and you need to be welcome to. Okay. I think we have representatives from the Center for Fred Legal Studies. Okay, we'll give you a minute to just set up. Remember, you can take a 2 minute leg stretch.
Amazing work. I love your work, son. Thank you.
I couldn't get a place to park.
I'm from Freedom of Religion South Africa.
Thank you.
anybody wants to say? Okay.
working also on verbal representation, because this goes quite technical, and it's just so that we have a better understanding in terms of what they actually deal with. But let me then hand over to you. You can introduce yourself and then go straight into your presentation.
Morning, Chairperson, honorable members, and fellow stakeholders. My name is Asisana Gwetsiri. I am joined by my colleague, Sandile Ndelu. We're from the Center of Applied Legal Studies, a civil society organization based at the School of Law at Wits University. So a little bit about background. So as a law clinic, CALS has also worked on a number of issues concerning women and children facing domestic violence, sexual violence, and harassment. And so our submissions are going to be, I hope I'm not too loud. And so our submissions are going to be, focused on domestic violence, sexual violence, and harassment. These methods also include aspects of online threats and coercion of minors that lead to sexual offences. We are thus not only well-versed in research around gender-based violence and online sexual harassment, but are aware of how this kind of violence plays out practically, including the serious consequences of survivors and the difficulties they face currently in reporting crimes of this nature. Our submissions are primarily concerned with offences outlined in Part 2 of the bill and related sections on sentencing, protection orders, but we also make reference to other sections of the bill. So just before I go into that, we'd like to commend the Select Committee on Security and Justice for taking a proactive approach and particularly for recognizing the seriousness of what is often referred to as revenge porn. We welcome the opportunity to comment on the bill and would like to draw attention to a number of aspects of the current draft, which we believe could benefit from reflection as we set out in detail below. Now, I want to start with the scope of the bill. So as we understand it, the purpose of the bill is to criminalize the distribution of data messages which are harmful and to provide for interim protection orders. In our opinion, the types of data messages contemplated in Part 2 of the bill, termed malicious communication, only represent a tiny fraction of possible forms of online interaction that may be considered harmful. The offenses outlined in the bill currently outline and criminalize a few examples of these kinds of conduct that constitute online harassment, and more specifically, online sexual harassment. And what we mean by online sexual harassment, it's a very well-documented phenomenon involving the use of digital content to threaten, coerce, extort, and discriminate against, humiliate, or otherwise cause harm to an intended victim. It can and may take many different forms, and it can include cyber-stalking, cyber-bullying, and cyber-grooming, or online predation. Instances of online harassment may be said to fall into two broad categories. Messages which are sent directly to victims and those posted about victims. In terms of Section 14 and Section 15 of the bill criminalizes messages sent to victims only if they contain a threat or incitement to cause damage or bodily harm. Section 16 criminalizes messages about victims only if they include an intimate message post without the victim's consent. And this, in our opinion, is quite narrow. So these sections are extremely limited in focus, and they don't take cognizance of the variety of forms of online harassment women and children in particular may be exposed to. For example, online threats of damage to property are a criminal offense, yet the Act makes no mention of grooming minors for the purposes of committing sexual offenses or exposing them to sexual contact online. Now, I'd like to shift from scope, and I'm going to shift now into sentencing and penalty. We also noted that there are also issues with the penalties imposed for those offences which are listed in the bill. Section 19.7 states that any person who contravenes Section 14, 15, or 16 is liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment. Section 56A of the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Act. This is an incorrect approach to dealing with sexual violence offences. All sexual offences should be treated as serious sexual offences and be added to the list of offences that attract minimum mandatory sentencing as set out under Section 51 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act 38 of 2007. In focusing on the seriousness of sexual violence, and particularly online sexual offences, some jurisdictions, such as the United States, have recognized that committing a sexual offence using a computer should actually be seen as a more serious crime, carrying on corresponding stronger penalties. For example, the United States Sentencing Commission Guidelines Manual suggests that a use of a computer to persuade, induce, entice, coerce, or facilitate the travel of a child to engage in prohibited sexual conduct should result in an enhanced sentence. In many cases, using online platforms gives an offense a greater potential for harm. For example, posting an intimate image of someone without their consent to a platform of a large audience means that the image may be seen and copied by thousands and even millions of people, and the resulting damage of the person's reputation, relationship, even earning potential could be enormous. Using online tools makes it possible to distribute more material to more people, more efficiently, in less time than corresponding offline crimes do. I'd like to now shift gears to the language of the bill. So there are some specific instances where the bill could benefit from a more inclusive approach to the use of language, particularly around the definition of some of the expressions relating to gender identity. The use of words such as female connotes a biological category, primarily used to refer to animals, and may be seen as a disrespectful way to refer to a group of people. It is also exclusionary. Conflating the word female and woman effectively erases gender non-conforming people and trans men and women. This does not make any sense in light of the fact that people depicted by maybe children who may not have breasts, but who should also be offered the greatest possible protection under the law, regardless of their stage of development. This definition should be made as inclusive as possible for children and adults of all gender identities and expressions. We would like to make the following further recommendations. Interpol draws a very useful distinction between cybercrime, on the one hand, a cyber-enabled crime, and on the other hand, it makes a distinction between cybercrime on the one hand and cyber-enabled crime on the other. Cybercrime is a term used to refer to crimes that are by nature technological and involve attacks onto computers, while cyber-enabled crimes are existing crimes which are now taking place using online media like child pornography. We would propose adopting a similar approach and restricting the cybercrimes bill to cybercrimes while adapting existing legislation to incorporate cyber-enabled crimes. Should the approach above not be feasible, we would recommend that the following sections be amended to be as inclusive as possible. Section 10 should be amended to include a specific reference to extortion for sexual acts and be included as a sexual offence with a corresponding strong sentence imposed. Section 12 should likewise be amended to include specific reference to theft of sexualized or intimate images and or sound and or video and or text and be included as a sexual offence with a corresponding stronger sentence imposed. Section 14 should be amended to account for any unwanted messages of a sexual nature as included as a sexual offence. Section 15 should likewise be amended to account for any unwanted messages of a sexual nature included as a sexual offence. It should also incorporate strips to remove content such as that as contemplated in Section 16. Section 16 should be broadened to include sexualized or intimate images, as well as sound and or video and or text. It should also be amended to remove mention of female and rather include the kind of data message which the complainant subjectively identifies as sexual. Section 19.7 should be amended to have the option of a fine removed for those convicted of a sexual offense. Section 21 should be amended to remove reference to the finalization of the order to be dependent on a separate criminal proceeding. And that's where I'll find
explicitly provide for revenge pornography, which included extortion based on pornography images. Why should section or clause 10 of the bill be amended to deal with that? Okay, earlier in the beginning I said that you said there are two types of manners how communication is distributed. And you say that, as I understand you, that the world doesn't provide for direct distribution and not for the secondary part. Somebody accesses the court shooting tennis of those 12 and take that as probably not too near, let me say, something that is not a crime in South Africa. But on the other hand, regarding certain soft part of images of pornography that is not catered for in the Amendment of the Sexual Offences Act will always fall within clause 16 of the bill that deals with distribution of intimate images. So do we need to include all that in clauses 14 and 15 as well? If you can clarify that for me. And I will provide a written response as to the presentation.
Thank you.
Coming with
that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Uncle. That was just a comment for you to take on, and when you make your responses, your further written responses, you take that into consideration. Thank you. Okay, freedom of religion in South Africa. Do you want to make a presentation? I'll give you some time to set that.
did.
Public violence are all already criminal offences for which there are
criminal penalties. We know that in terms of the Riotous Assemblies Act 17 of 1956, incitement to commit any crime is already punishable in terms of that act. So again, the incitement is already covered in its broader sense by another act. Then there are other acts which also may apply, the Intimidation Act 72 of 1982, and in terms of that act, that's the act on which certain parts have been struck down by the Constitutional Court in the case of Moyo in October of this year. However, the part that still remains in the Intimidation Act and that still remains a crime is where a person unlawfully and with a view to compel another to do something or not to do something assaults or injures another person or damages their property or threatens their personal safety or threatens damage to their property. So again, much of what appears now in the Cybercrimes Bill is already covered by the Intimidation Act, I think that's Section 1B. Then other acts which cover very similar type of offences, if not the same, would be the Protection from Harassment Act 17 of 2011, and then of course hate speech, which is particularly dealt with in, for instance, the Form and Publications Amendment Act, which was amended this very year, 11 of 2019, where there's a large overlap in terms of the types of content that would be covered by the Cybercrimes Bill and the Form and Publications Amendment Bill. And then of course, PAPUDA, the Equality Act 4 of 2000, which also has a very specific definition of hate speech and prohibits certain types of content that would be regarded as hate speech. So in light of all those things, we are saying perhaps we should be careful not to unnecessarily duplicate what is already on the law books and in the process cause some confusion or possible uncertainty with regard to the public as to what is or isn't a crime and the penalties that may apply. Because when we have all these different pieces of legislation, each with their own crime, their own penalty, it may make it very hard, both from a prosecuting point of view and for the public simply to know what is and isn't a crime and what is the penalty that they could potentially suffer. A further concern is just that the provisions are potentially overbroad, as I point out now, in the sense that they go further than the Constitution. And finally, that some of them may have unintended consequences. In other words, it criminalizes communication that it is not intended. And here I just, as a departure point, want to remind us that the right to freedom of speech, the constitutional right to freedom of speech, which is guaranteed to every citizen in Section 16 of the Constitution as a fundamental human right, is a broad right. And again, very recently, there's been a number of cases in the Supreme Court of Appeal, the Constitutional Court, where they said it's very important that remains a broad right and that it includes even speech which is regarded as offensive, as inflammatory, even as hostile, because it's a critical right to, it's the hallmark of a democratic society, the right to even, to have this right of free speech, that even free speech that is potentially hostile. So we should be very careful to not make any unnecessary cutting into this right of freedom of speech. That just as an intro, if we move into the specific clauses in the bill, and just again to say we confine our submissions to malicious communication, that's part 2, chapter 2 of the bill. So clauses 13 to 15, we know, criminalise messages that incite on the one hand, and in the next clause 15, threaten violence to a person or damage to property. Now, as I indicated just now, one of our concerns is that the clauses as they appear currently in the bill are in some respects narrower than Section 16.2 of the Constitution, which deals with unprotected speech and which is a very limited category of speech that it says we have this broad right of speech, but there are certain forms of speech that's prohibited, that remain unprotected. And the Constitution is very specific regarding what those prohibited forms of speech are. And it says it's these things and only these things. And the three things in terms of the Constitution, Section 16.2 of the Constitution, which is not protected, which is prohibited speech, is propaganda for war, incitement, and this is very important, incitement to imminent violence. Not just any kind of violence that's going to take place in a year, 5 years, maybe, perhaps, maybe not. Imminent violence. And then thirdly, the advocacy of hatred based on race, ethnicity, gender, religion, and that constitutes an incitement to cause harm. So not just the stirring up of hatred, but actually calling forth, going out and doing something about it. Thank you. So three categories of content that is specifically prohibited by the Constitution. So we turn to the clauses in the bill, and narrower than the Constitution in the sense that it doesn't provide for propaganda for war, which is maybe something that should be included in the bill. It is narrower than the Constitution in the sense that it doesn't make provision for the advocacy of hatred that constitutes an incitement to cause harm. But it's broader than Section 16(2) of the Constitution in the sense that it just says incitement to violence and doesn't confine it to imminent violence. So our recommendation would be, in light of the fact that this is specifically dealt with in the Constitution, that it's specifically dealt with in other laws, that perhaps speak this entire chapter or these clauses pertaining to malicious communication be removed from the bill altogether. If the committee were not to find favour with that particular recommendation, our second option, option B almost, would be to stick to the wording of Section 16(2) of the Constitution, because it's very important that consistency. So stick to propaganda for war, incitement to imminent violence, advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. But then in the final option, we would say that should the committee be of the opinion that the bill should deal with malicious communications in a broader sense than what is provided for in the Constitution, in other words, those three categories, then we would make certain recommendations for slight tweaks to be made to the specific clauses so as to bring it in line with the Constitution. And in this regard, we really have three proposals. So my first proposal is just perhaps a matter of better clarification and therefore certainty. And I would suggest there that Section 13, the definitional clause, where it describes what a related person is, that it be amended as to read as follows. And I take note of the request that was made to Kelv by the Honourable Member in the previous instance, saying please can you indicate the specific words. So if I may make a recommendation with regards to specific words. At the moment it reads as follows. Related person means any member of the family or household of a person or any other person in a close relationship with that person. However, what we would recommend is perhaps to, in front of the word member of the family, to insert the words identified or unidentified. Because if there were to be a threat, for instance, in the cyberspace saying we're going to kill your family or cause your household harm, whether those persons are identified or whether identified as a group, family or household, they're still identifiable. But then, to in front of it, so it would read, related person means any identified or unidentified member of the family or household of a person, or any other, and then we would recommend including the word identified then, or any identified person in a close relationship with that person. Just to make the reach and the scope narrower, because otherwise if someone were to just tweet and I'm going to cause someone close to you harm, that may be too wide for criminal purposes. But at least in that instance, if it's an identified person in a close relationship, that would perhaps be more reasonable from a criminalizing perspective. So that on Section 13. Then our next proposal would be, and this turns on the whole issue of imminence. If I may just remind the committee again that in terms of the Constitution is very emphatic that it's not just incitement to violence that is prohibited, but incitement to imminent violence. And this is indeed the matter that was dealt with in the recent constitutional case of Moyo. Moyo and another business minister of police and others, Santi and another business minister of police and others in October. As I said, this was in the context of the Intimidation Act, but the same pronouncement by the Constitutional Court would apply nonetheless in this instance. If I may just read a certain paragraph from the judgment. The court in this instance said that if a proper reading of the section, now we're talking about the Intimidation Act, but the same would apply here. If a proper reading of the section does not include incitement of imminent violence, but only covers intentional conduct that creates an objectively reasonable fear of harm to person, property, or security of livelihood, then it would criminalize protected free speech and probably also peaceful forms of protest. And there are some other paragraphs, so that's in paragraph 69, but the same is expressed by the Constitutional Court in paragraph 65 and 68 of the judgment, where it's very clear that the threshold that the Constitutional Court sets for incitement of violence in order to meet that threshold where it's unprotected, where it will not classify free speech, is incitement of imminent violence, not just any violence. And for that reason, we would recommend that in the bill, in clause 14, And 15, every place where the word violence appears, that the word imminent should go before. And that the same should really apply with regards to the causing of any damage. Because in terms of the Constitution, where it speaks about violence, it doesn't only refer to bodily harm. The violence in that context also refers to damage to property. And even there, we can see the Constitutional Court regards that kind of damage to property to be of an imminence. That's the threshold that must be met. So to bring it in line with the Constitution and with a recent announcement by the Constitutional Court, we would recommend that the word imminent be included. And then finally, a very short, really, matter of semantics. Section 15.1 of the bill currently reads as follows: a person commits an offence if he or she unlawfully and intentionally, and then it carries on. A very small thing, minor thing, but I would just submit that it would be appropriate to include the word it there. A person commits an offence if he, she, or it unlawfully and intentionally. This has got nothing to do with gender. What it has got to do with is the word person in the definitional section of the bill is defined as not only a natural person but a juristic person. So it would make sense there just to cover all that, to make sure that it includes there also. It's not only a reference to a natural person but also to a juristic person. Honourable Chair, those are my submissions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I think you were quite specific in terms of the changes you would recommend. I'll open it up to Sarah if you have any questions for clarity. And thereafter, members will come.
Thank you, Ms. Tegerson. You did refer to the Moya judgment that she got in the Implementation Act. On the 28th of July this year, there was a full bench decision by two certified courts, specifically relating to incitement to commit an offence. And according to the court, incitement per se should not or cannot be limited by the imminent harm factor. I think the court also probably say yes, you can read a text of harassment act on the one side together with the other criminalizing provisions, but what do you do with the imminent image, the images that is on the internet? It stays there. At least here, in terms of that chapter, there is provision for orders to ensure you remove this communication. One act you can probably argue, ECTA can be applied to take down notification in terms of section 73 of the ECTA can apply, but that section to say is subject to some controversy since freedom of expression is constitutional. And there's no judicial officer intervention necessary for a takedown notification. At least here, there's some antecedents that ensure that can justify the takedown notification. If you can respond to that, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, just with regard to the question on the judgment by the Western Cape High Court, unfortunately I'm not so familiar with that judgment, and perhaps taking your lead from the previous submissions by CALS, we would take some time just to study that judgment and to the extent necessary make a brief further submission on that. Of course, to the extent that the Constitutional Court judgment contradicts the Western Cape judgment, that would override what the Western Cape Court has said, but we would need to check whether it's indeed on the same legal principles whether it's dealing with the same legal principles. Then secondly, with regard to the issue of malicious communications distributed through the internet, whether there can be imminent threat of violence, and the example was used of a picture or a message that was sent from a different jurisdiction saying the right in a different jurisdiction. Now, of course, I've read that the Cyber Crimes Act would apply, the intention that it would apply cross jurisdictional, and that is definitely to be commendable because that is, of course, in just the cyber age in which we live. That's one of the very problems that we are facing, as we've also seen on social media. We have similar issues, but perhaps in the context of racial remarks that were made, but so it's definitely good that it applies cross jurisdictionally. And I would agree that malicious communication certainly can be distributed through the internet and that there can be threats of imminent violence. But whether it does in fact meet that threshold of imminent violence would be dependent on the content. So I think as a matter of principle, yes, it can be distributed through the internet, but the question is, as it is in any other given scenario where the court has to decide, does a specific statement meet the threshold of the Constitution? Does it amount to propaganda for war? Does it amount to imminent violence, given the intention of the speaker, given how it would have been heard by a reasonable person in that context, whether that would amount to that threshold. So I think ultimately it would have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis to see does it actually amount to imminent violence in that particular instance. Then thirdly, with regard to the overlap of laws, indeed it is that the Protection of Harassment Act only goes so far as in as much as it provides interdictory relief, a protection order. But of course, that's not the only relief that is available in law, whether by statute or by common law, because we know that in any instance where damages is suffered, whether it's reputational damages, damages for the dignity that's been impaired, whether it's damage because of a result to property, there are civil remedies available. And then of course, we know that even in criminal law, even though it's not the norm, application can be made for criminal damages to be awarded. So even in terms of just a normal statute and common law, it's not as if everything's dependent on the Cyber Crimes Bill to make that a reality. And then finally, just with regards to the submission on if we are arguing that clauses 14 and 15 are unnecessary, mustn't the section 16 relating to revenge porn or rather the intimate images then also drop out? At outset, I must say, obviously, Section 16 is not our area of expertise, and I would do extend a further CALS in this regard. But perhaps I cannot, from a freedom of religion point of view, but just as a legal person, just drop my two cents for what it's worth. And my question, even when CALS was making the submission on CLAP that I was here, was while there certainly is a need to to deal with the range of sexual offences that they refer to in legislation. My question is, does it belong in the cybercrime bill? Because a large number of the offences that they refer to doesn't only happen on the internet, but also happens just in life, one-on-one, and through other manners of communication. So while there's certainly a need to address it from a legislative point of view, shouldn't something like that perhaps be better addressed in, for instance, the Sexual Offences Law Amendment Act, where it can cover the same type of offences, but where it's committed on a broader platform and rather than just the internet. And then also another act that came to mind and that may be relevant in that context is, of course, the POPI Act, the Protection of Personal Information Act, which may also deal with the taking down of certain images and so forth. So my two pieces.